ॐ असतो मा सद्गमय, तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय, मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। त्वमेव माता च पिता त्वमेव, त्वमेव बन्धुश्च सखा त्वमेव, त्वमेव विद्या द्रविणं त्वमेव, त्वमेव सर्वं मम देवदेव। गुरुर्ब्रह्मा गुरुर्विष्णुः गुरुर्देवो महेश्वरः, गुरुः साक्षात् परब्रह्म, तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। कस्तूरितिलकं ललाटपटले वक्षस्थले कौस्तुभम्, नासाग्रे वरमौक्तिकम्, करतले वेणुः, करे कङ्कणम्, सर्वाङ्गे हरिचन्दनम्, सुललितम्, कण्ठे च मुक्तावली, गोपस्त्री परिवेष्टितो विजयते गोपालचूडामणिः, अस्ति स्वस्तरुणी, कराग्रविगलत्, कल्पप्रसूनाप्लुतम्, वस्तुप्रस्तुत वेणुनादलहरी, निर्वाणनिर्व्याकुलम्, स्रस्तस्रस्तनिबद्ध, नीविविलसत्, गोपीसहस्रावृतम्, हस्तन्यस्तन तापवर्गमखिलोदारम्, किशोराकृति। सो टुडे सिक्स्थ सक्सेसफुल डे, होपफुली सक्सेसफुल डे. वी प्लान टू कवर दि अमृत मथनम, द स्टोरी इन विच the devas and asuras collaborate and churn the milky ocean in search of the amritam. There is no translation for amritam, it is very approximately translated as nectar, okay, but nectar has a very different meaning compared to amritam. So amritam means immortality. The word amritam means immortality. And nectar is any juice that you get out of any flower. So the word nectar is a very, I would say, insulting translation to amritam, but nevertheless, let's call amritam amritam. So, you know, the devas and the asuras, you know, really speaking, they are stepbrothers. They are born to the same father, but to different mothers. So the Rishi Kashyapa is the common father to both devas and asuras, and Diti is the mother of all the asuras, and Aditi is the mother of all the devas. But even though they are born of the same father, they are very opposite in their character and disposition. So the devas are considered to be the good people and the asuras are the not so good people. And so in terms of the Shastric terminology, the devas are sattva dominated and the asuras are Rajas, Tamas dominated. So I have to explain what is Sattva, Tamas and Rajas. So, you know, in the Vedic philosophy, we are told that all of this material world can ultimately be reduced to one material principle or matter principle, which is called Prakriti. Okay, so Prakriti is the matter principle, and Prakriti is actually dead and inert matter. Okay, but even though it is dead and inert matter, it becomes alive because of the blessings of Purusha, and Purusha is pure consciousness or Chaitanya. Okay, now without going into the details of the, you know, the other information, so Prakriti becomes alive because of the blessings of Purusha. So it borrows consciousness, it borrows life from Purusha and becomes alive. And in this borrowed liveliness, Prakriti exhibits three types of gunas. So you can imagine the gunas to be a kind of thread. So there are three types of threads, or you can say three types of characters or three types of qualities. So one is sattva guna, the other is rajo guna, the other is, third is tamo guna. Now sattva guna, when a person is predominantly sattva oriented, he becomes very mentally very capable. His thinking, his thought process, his intelligence, his ability to receive information, to process information, to understand and express. So all these mental and thinking faculties are extenuate, you know, very exalted. That is the sattva domination. And there are a lot of other conclusions which can draw from the sattva, but I'm keeping this explanation short. In rajo guna dominated personality, the person will be physically very active. So all those physical activity that the person, you know, exhibits, running here and there and carrying heavy weights and, you know, going through a lot of physical hardships and still coming out with good stamina. So all those things are the characteristics of a rajoguna dominated individual. And tamoguna is the absence of both. So tamoguna, even though we define tamoguna as a third entity, it is essentially very low sattva and very low rajas. So it characterizes or manifests in the form of laziness, sleep, dullness of the brain. All those things are tamoguna. Dullness of the brain, dullness of the body, everything. So these are the three characteristics or qualities that Prakriti is capable of exhibiting. And the theory of creation says that before the creation started, Prakriti maintains all these three gunas in complete equilibrium. So you have exactly the same amount of sattva guna, rajo guna and tamo guna in the whole of cosmos. And when creation begins, this equilibrium is disturbed. Disturbed in the sense, different entities are formed with different combinations of these three gunas. So you get one set of entities who are very highly sattva dominated and minimum rajas and tamas. And then you get another set of creation or creatures or, you know, entities which are created with a lot of raja guna and a little bit of sattvam and tamas. And then there are other creatures which are created which are very, very tamas dominated and a little bit of sattva and rajas. So this is how the creation is explained in all our philosophies, including in Bhagavatam. In Bhagavatam, there is a particular chapter where the Kapila avatara, you know, Bhagavan Vishnu has several avataras, and in one of those avataras, he is born to a certain lady called Devahuti, and his name is Kapila. And as Kapila avatara, he teaches, you know, the Sankhya philosophy. The Sankhya, whatever I explained to you now in terms of Prakriti, Purusha and all those gunas, it is called Sankhya philosophy. And that Sankhya philosophy is taught by Kapila Rishi to the mother Devahuti. So there is a very elaborate chapter. In fact, there are 3-4 chapters and it is a very philosophical section. So I am not venturing into that. So the story part is very small and the philosophy part is very big. Okay, but I am trying to tell you all this because Devas are sattva dominant and Asuras or Rakshasas or Rajas Tamas dominant. Okay, so there is a conflict between them all the time. And they always get into a battle. So Devas and Asuras keep fighting, and you hear about lot of different fights in so many different Puranas. And in some battles, the Devas win, but very often you see the Asuras end up winning. They end up dominating the Devas, and then the Devas go and fall and pray to some lord or the other. In Devi Bhagavatam, they will immediately pray to Lord, the Devi Parvati or Durga Devi, and Durga will come and rescue them. In Shiva Puranam, they will go and pray to Shiva, and the Shiva will rescue them, and so on. In Bhagavatam, invariably the Devas end up praying to Lord Vishnu. So in one such instance, in all those long series of battles, in one such instance, the Asuras had defeated the Deva. And when this Asura victory happened, the king of the Asuras is Mahabali. And Mahabali is none other than the grandson of Prahlada. So last week, I think we saw the Narasimha Avataram and we saw the Prahlada story. And there, Prahlada is granted a lot of boons and he becomes a king and he rules for a very long time and then he goes to Moksham. His son Virochana then takes over as the king. And Virochana rules for a long time. I told you the story of Virochana going to Brahmaloka for learning the Brahma Vidya from Brahmaji himself. That story I said mentioned in Chandogya Upanishad. After Virochana is gone, his son Mahabali takes over, and in this particular case, when the Asuras win over Devas and dominate them, Mahabali is the king. And Mahabali, unlike many other Asuras, is a slightly more dharmic Asura in that sense. Okay, so he knows that, he is a very learned man. He is also knows the Shastras. He knows what is good and bad. So he is among the Asuras, he is a reasonably good guy. Okay, and especially because he is in the same progeny, ancestry or dynasty as Prahlada, so a lot of Prahlada's influence is in Mahabali, so he is not all that evil. Okay, but still, Asuras being Asuras, they tend to dominate and create problem for the Devas, and the Devas are upset. And typically what happens in all these battles between Devas and Asuras, a lot of casualties on both sides. And the Devas are worried because the Devas are smaller in number. The Devas are supposed to be 33 crores and the Asuras are supposed to be 66 crores. So the number of Asuras is double the head count of Devas. So for the Devas, every head count that is lost in a battle is a big loss. So they are worried, and this battle was probably a very bitter and very severely fought battle. They probably had more casualties. So they all get together and they don't know what to do, how to stop this casualty. And then they go and pray to Lord Brahma. Because Brahma is their boss. If something happens in Indra Loka and Indra gets into trouble, the first escalation level is Brahmaji. So they go to Brahmaji and pray to him and say, please tell us what can we do. We are losing people every war and We cannot live with this kind of casualty forever, so you have to give us some solution. And then Brahmaji thinks for a while, and then he says, let's all go to Kailasha, and they go to Kailasha and they consult with Lord Shiva also. And there also they get no proper solution. And finally they all decide to pray jointly to Lord Vishnu. So they all perform a joint tapas for so many years, and they all pray to Lord Vishnu. And that portion of the Bhagavatam is again a very beautiful set of shlokas where you find the prayer to the Lord Vishnu in very beautiful terms and description of Vishnu. Hey, you are the creator of this earth and you are the savior of the earth and not just earth, the whole creation. So you are the Srishtikarta, Stitikarta, Layakarta, all those descriptions, they address Vishnu, and they offer a lot of offerings in terms of yajna. And then after, say, 100 or 1000 years, the Vishnu, Lord Vishnu appears in front of them. And he says, okay, I'm very happy with all that puja that you have done. And I know what your problem is. So you don't have to tell me what you are praying for. I know what your issues are. So I'll make a suggestion. So you people have to now
churned the milky ocean and get amritam. And in this churning of the milky ocean, he says, don't do it all by yourself. You make sure that the asuras are your partners. So this idea of partnering with asuras is given by Lord Vishnu himself. Okay? So we'll analyze the, you know, implications later on, like after we complete the story, we'll come back and see what each of these things mean. Yeah? So Lord Vishnu says, you have to churn this milky ocean. Milky ocean is where Vishnu is, you know, supposed to be living. And it's part of Vaikuntham. And he says there is a particular mountain called Mandara Parvata. It's a huge mountain. That Mandara Parvata you have to use as your, you know, manthan, whatever you call it. In English there is no word for it. You know, in Tamil we call it Mathu. No, it's actually a stick with which you put in a pot of buttermilk and you do with your hand or do with some rope and ultimately you get butter out of it. So that mathanam or the churning process, you need some kind of a rod, churning rod. Okay? So he says, use the Mandara Parvata as a churning rod. And there is a divine snake called Vasuki. And that Vasuki is the brother of Sesha. Adi Sesha is a serpent on which Lord Vishnu is lying down. So Adi Sesha and Vasuki are supposed to be brothers. So he says, I can't give you Adi Sesha, he is my bed. But I can recommend Vasuki for you. So you go and request Vasuki to, you know, become the rope with which you churn. And then you have to get all the herbs and all the nutritious plants from Himalayas and all other places and put it in the Milky Ocean and then you churn. And after a while, you will get Amritam. But he also warns that in between, you will get a lot of other things. Don't go after them. You wait until Amritam comes and be patient. If something else comes in between, don't hanker for it. Just leave it as it is. Okay. And then the devas, you know, they hear this and they ask, okay, what is the guarantee that the asuras will, you know, cooperate with us? They are always, you know, adversaries and they are always fighting against us. So what is the surety that the asuras will come and, you know, team up with us? So Vishnu says, don't worry, Mahabali is a sensible guy. You go and tell Mahabali that this recommendation actually came from Vishnu and he will agree. With that, Devendra and his devas, they all go to Mahabali's capital. And as they enter, the asuras start hitting and attacking them. Because the asuras don't know why devas have come. And for them, devas means only one thing, attack. So they start attacking and then Mahabali says, no, stop, don't. No, they have come with some idea, let's hear them out. And then if required, we'll attack. So he stops the army. And he allows Devendra to come and tell what the plan is. So then Devendra goes and bows before Mahabali and says, you know, he praises Mahabali, hey, you are a supreme king, you are a great guy, you know, this, that and all that. And then he says, you know, I have come with a proposal. What is the proposal? Lord Vishnu told that we can get Amritam. And he says, you know, if you cooperate, we can have a share of the Amritam. And Mahabali says, okay, what is this Amritam? He says, if you drink Amritam, then you conquer death. You know, the word Amritam itself is immortality. So you can conquer death. So then this idea sounds reasonable and good to Mahabali. So he says, okay, let's, go and do this project. And then they all go in search of Mandara Parvatam. And, full of energy and enthusiasm, they start lifting the Mandara Parvatam and they think they can carry it to, Vaikuntha. Halfway, the weight of the Parvatam is so heavy that with all these 66 crore asuras and 33 crore devas, they are not able to carry that Parvatam. So it falls down and in that process, a lot of people are crushed underneath the mountain and, many of them lose their legs and hands and all that. So a lot of casualties even before the project starts. So then they again pray to Lord Vishnu and then Lord Vishnu comes on his Garuda Vahana. And just with the Garuda Vahana, Garuda picks up. In fact, Vishnu doesn't do anything. He tells Garuda to pick up the Mandara Parvata. Garuda simply picks it up. No, Garuda is an eagle, right? Eagle can pick up anything. So the eagle has very powerful hand, claws. And Garuda is not an ordinary eagle. He is a divine eagle, so he can pick up anything. And it says, Garuda is so great that he carries Lord Vishnu himself on him. So for someone who is carrying Lord Vishnu, he is so powerful, carrying one more Mandara Parvatam is not a big deal. So he simply, Garuda carries the Mandara Parvatam and takes it to Vaikuntha, drops it into the Milky Ocean, and then Vishnu says, now you go back. Because if Garuda continues to remain in that place, because Garuda is also interested in seeing how this Amrita Manthanam is going to happen, so he wants to watch the fun. But Lord Vishnu knows that if Garuda is here, Vasuki won't come, because Vasuki and Garuda are enemies. So he wants to make sure that Vasuki feels comfortable coming to this place. So he says, Garuda, you now leave the place. So Garuda promptly goes off, and then the Devas and Asuras, in the meantime, all those injured people, Vishnu brings them back to normal strength and shape and all that. So the head count is now, you know, restored back to the original head count. No casualties, no losses. And then they all go to Vasuki, and they tell him that, you know, we request you to become the rope for the Manthanam. You know, it's a very big project, and he says, what is the benefit for me? So they offer him also a portion of the Amritam. So that's the deal. So Vasuki agrees to come, and he becomes the rope. And then Devas, Asuras, they all go to Himalayas and all the places and gather all the herbs and all the, you know, nutritional plants and trees and everything, and they put it into the Milky Ocean, and they start churning. Before they start churning, what happens? Lord Vishnu goes and stands near the head of Vasuki. And he had told the Devas before, you do whatever I do. Don't ask questions. Whatever I do, simply follow whatever I am doing. So when he goes and stands near the head of the Vasuki serpent, all the Devas also go and stand near the head. Because, you know, the rope, you have two ends. And one party has to hold it on one side, another party has to hold it on the other side. And so if the Devas have come and taken the head side, obviously the Asuras have to take the tail side. Now these guys have an issue. They say, no, we are equally educated. We are also trained in the Vedas and we are equally qualified. Why do you want us to go and touch the tail of the snake? It's a dirty place, and we don't want to do Mathanam from the tail side. We want only the head side. Then Vishnu says, okay, no problem, and Vishnu moves to the tail side, and Devas come to the tail side and Asuras go to the head side. Okay? Now why all this drama? Because in a few minutes, when the churning happens, Vasuki will start emitting very poisonous fumes. Okay, because Vasuki is also a living snake, and he is a poisonous snake. And when he is being pulled left and right like this, he is also going to face that stream, and his breathing is going to be painful, and he is going to emit a lot of poisonous fumes. And it is the Rakshasas, Asuras, who chose to be on the head side. Now they can't complain, and they can't come and say, you give us a tail side. So Krishna wanted to, Vishnu wanted to make sure that the Devas are protected from the fumes, so he kind of plays this drama. Okay, now the churning has started. Now after a few back and forth, the mountain slips and falls into the ocean, because there is nothing to support the ocean at the bottom. And you know, the ocean's floor is very hard. If you try to churn with the, mountain sitting on the floor, it is going to be very rough, because we all know sliding friction is more than rolling friction, so we have all studied in physics, whoever has remembered his physics. So after a few churning, the mountain doesn't hang, it just falls into the floor, and they are not able to churn further. At this time they again pray to Lord Vishnu, and then Lord Vishnu takes the form of a tortoise, a huge tortoise. He goes under the ocean and he lifts the the entire Parvatam on his shell, and at the same time he also holds the top of the mountain with another avatar. In this Samudra Mathanam, you will see that Vishnu has taken multiple avatarams. Now he takes Kurma avataram, and then to hold the Parvatam from the top, he has to hold it from the top. And in the Bhagavatam it says that he also acted through the bodies of the Devas and Asuras, giving them the energy. Okay, so really speaking, the Samudra Mathanam is something that Vishnu himself does. But the Devas and Asuras get the impression that they are doing it. Okay, so this is another point to note. Okay, so in the Bhagavatam it is very clearly said that at the bottom of the Mandara Parvatam, Vishnu is supporting the Parvatam as a tortoise, Kurma Avatara, and from the top of the mountain he is holding it with his hand, and he has entered the bodies of the devas and asuras and given them the energy to hold the rope and do the churning, and he is also entered into the body of Vasuki to make sure that Vasuki feels comfortable. So he is doing everything. Okay, so before all this happened, I told Vasuki emits all those fumes, noxious fumes, and the asuras are suffering because of that. But then somehow they understand that, okay, we were tricked into, being on the head side. What can we do? We have to bear with it. So with all those difficulties, they are now churning. And the churning is happening. And as the churning goes on, the very first thing that comes out of the ocean is the most poisonous halahala visham. No, the halahala visham is basically a poison. It's supposed to be the most toxic of all poison. And so that visham comes out. And the devas are terrified, asuras are also terrified, and they don't know what to do. And they are looking for somebody who can protect them from this poison. And finally somebody says, let's go and pray to Lord Shiva. So the devas and asuras, they all go and pray to Lord Shiva and say, this visham has come, it is really torturing us. As it is, the snake is emitting poisonous fume, and on top of it, this halahala visham is coming. So we are not able to continue with the churning, so please help us. And then Lord Shiva, he falls for any great prayer. So Shiva is the most easy Lord to please. You give a good puja and a good set of prayers, Shiva is very happy and he'll give you whatever you want. So Shiva says, fine, I will consume that poison. So Shiva takes that halahala visham and consumes it, and that is why he is supposed to have got this blue neck. That's why he's called Neelakanta. So now that the halahala visham has been tackled, and then they keep churning, and one by one lot of ratnas come. The Bhagavatam says there are 14 ratnas that come. This halahala visham is also one of those ratnas. Okay, so after the halahala visham, some 13 different things come, and the last and final thing to emerge from the samudram is the amritam itself. Okay, so what are the things that come out of this ocean in this churning process? There is something called the Kaustubha Ratna. So Kaustubha Ratna is a precious stone, and that Kaustubha Ratna, it is offered to Lord Vishnu. So Lord Vishnu is supposed to be wearing that Kaustubha gem on his in a garland, like necklace like ornament. That is Kaustubha Ratna, and after that the Kamadhenu comes. Now Kamadhenu is a divine cow, and it is not just a cow that gives milk. So Kamadhenu is a cow which will give anything that you want. So you go and tell in front of Kamadhenu, I want a palatial house, it will give you a palatial house then and there. So anything that you want, that Kamadhenu is capable of giving. So that Kamadhenu, in spite of Vishnu telling Indra, not to covet any of these things, Indra takes that Kamadhenu. Okay? Then, the next thing that comes out is a horse, a very powerful horse called Uchchaishravas. That Uchchaishravas also, Indra wants to take. But then Mahabali takes it. And then Vishnu tells him, keep quiet, it will anyway come back to you, so don't worry. So Mahabali takes Uchchaishravas, which later on Indra manages to get it. Then the next to come is Airavatam. Airavatam is an elephant. And this Airavatam is a famed elephant. It is capable of flying. It is so powerful, it can go from anywhere to anywhere. And it has four tusks. It's a white elephant. So it's a divine elephant. And that Indra takes. After that, the Parijata tree comes. The Parijata tree is a tree that gives the flower Parijatam. And that Parijata flower is supposed to be a very divine smell. It is supposed to have a very divine smell. So that Indra takes for his heaven. And after that, another tree called Kalpataru or Kalpaka Vriksham comes. And Kalpaka Vriksham also it got some quality like Kamadhenu. You sit under the tree and ask for anything, it will give you. So that also Indra manages to take. And after that, all the Apsaras, Apsaras women, Ramba, Urvashi, Menaka, Tilottama, all those people, some 12 or 14 of those Apsaras trees, they come out of the ocean. Okay, they're supposed to be extremely beautiful. They can sing and dance and perform all sorts of performances. So they decide to join the Deva team. You know, they looked around and saw the Asuras. They didn't like them, so they decided we'll go and join the Deva team. So the Apsaras become part of the Devaloka. Then after this, Lakshmi Devi emerges from this Milky Ocean. Lakshmi Devi, in the Bhagavatam, the Lakshmi Devi's avataram from the Milky Ocean is dealt with very elaborately. She comes out and she is so beautiful, she is so shining and she is so magnificent that almost everybody there, wants to covet her. But she has got a garland in her hands and she is looking around to see who is the best candidate to get married to. So there is a Lakshmi Swayamvaram that happens. And in the Bhagavatam, there are a lot of descriptions as to, she looks at every single person and looks at the pluses and minuses and then says, no, I don't want him, I don't want him. So she first looks at Brahmaji and then she thinks, yeah, he's okay, but he's not, controlled his desire. So I don't want to be, living with somebody who cannot control his desire. And then she looks at Durvasa and she thinks, yeah, he's all right, but he is not able to control his anger. So I don't want to live with someone who can get very angry, at the drop of a pin. And like that, she looks at everybody and she looks at Shiva also. And then she finds Shiva to be not so desirable because, he is having all kinds of ashes on his body. He is wearing some elephant's leather, skin on his as a dress. He's got the snake as his garland and, he doesn't look very pleasant. So Lakshmi decides, no, Shiva is not the man for me. And finally, she puts the garland on Vishnu's neck and she marries Vishnu. So this Lakshmi Swayamvaram is a very beautiful part in this whole Samudra Mathanam story, which is dealt with a lot of description. And then after this Lakshmi's emergence, there's some more things that emerge. Chandran or the moon is supposed to have come along with Lakshmi. So that's why Lakshmi, if you read the Lakshmi Ashtotaram, it says Chandram Chandra Sahodrim. So she is supposed to be the sister of Chandra. Lakshmi is supposed to be the sister of Chandra. So she is called Chandra Sahodari and she is also called Chandra. Like Chandran is the masculine, Chandra is the feminine. So that comes from here. And then there is another lady who comes out. She is the Varuni Kanyaka. And this Varuni Kanyaka is the Devata for Sura. And Sura in Sanskrit is alcohol. So she is the Devata for alcohol and Asuras promptly take her. So the alcohol Devata joins the Asura clan. Okay. And then there is a Hari Dhanush. Dhanush is a bow. So Hari Dhanush comes out of the Samudram. And as the name suggests, it goes to Vishnu and Vishnu takes that Hari Dhanush. And then this conch, Panchajanya, comes out of the Samudram. That also Vishnu takes. Okay. And finally, after all of these things, one very glorious saint emerges from the Samudram with the pot of Amritam in his hand. This glorious saint is none other than Dhanvantri. So Dhanvantri is also supposed to be emerging from the Samudram and in our system, in our Vedic system, Dhanvantri is supposed to be the author of Ayurveda. And all medicine-related, treatment-related literature that you find in Ayurveda, they are all credited to Dhanvantri. And there are people who worship Dhanvantri as a Vishnu form and they perform Dhanvantri Puja. And there are some temples in the south also, where Dhanvantri Sannidhi is there, Dhanvantri is worshipped. And if some people are sick, they go and perform Archana or Puja to Dhanvantri to get rid of their sickness and all that. So there is Dhanvantri worship is very popular in the south. I am not sure about the north. Maybe north also, there are Dhanvantri worshippers. Antariksh can tell me.
No, I have not heard about Dhanvantri temples. Okay.
Yeah. So Dhanvantri is the author of Ayurveda, and he is supposed to be the physician, you know, after Ashwini Devatas. You know, Ashwini Devatas are supposed to be the Deva's physician. There is another story in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad where there is a particular rishi who has a very secret vidya, and these Ashwini Devatas go and request that rishi. He is called Dadhyang Atharvana Rishi, and this Dadhyang Atharvana Rishi has a particular vidya that he has learned, and these rishis, these Ashwini Devatas want to learn that from him. But then the rishi says, you know, I can't teach you because Indra has warned me that if I teach this to anybody, he'll take my head off. So I don't want to lose my head, and so while I want to teach you the vidya, I cannot teach you because of this constraint. Then this Ashwini Devatas, they are actually twins. Ashwini Devatas are always twins. They are two Devatas. So they strike a deal with this Dadhyang Atharvana Rishi, and they say that, you know, let's trick Indra. You know, we will now replace your original head with the head of a horse. And you teach us the vidya with your horse's head. And then Indra will come and remove your horse head. And then we will replace the original head with you. So this is the deal. So that shows that Ashwini Devatas are so skilled in their treatment, in their understanding of the physical body, that they can do anything. No, today the scientists are struggling to understand how to do head transplant and brain transplant and all that. So in the Upanishad, you have a story where this has actually happened. You know, whether it is true or not, that's not the point. So the thinking that you find in the Vedas and Upanishads is so advanced that, you know, I'm not sure you'll find such a story in any other scripture, in any other world religion. Yeah. So this story is actually found in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So this Dadhyang Atharvana Rishi agrees to the deal. So the Ashwini Devatas replace his original head with a horse's head, and store the original head carefully somewhere, and they learn the vidya from this rishi, which he teaches from his horse head. And in fact, that story is mentioned in Bhagavatam also, as a footnote it is mentioned somewhere. And then Indra comes to know that the rishi leaked the information, so he comes and cuts off the head. And then, you know, to keep their deal, they keep their promise, the Ashwini Devatas bring the original head and stitch it back and put this rishi, you know, back into life. So this is a diversion. Anyway, so Dhanvantri, Ashwini Devata, they are all devatas in charge of healing the body. So they are supposed to be experts in the medical science. And so when this Dhanvantri emerges from the Samudram with the Amrita Kalasham in his hand, all hell breaks loose. You know, the Asuras know that this is the thing, and we should somehow catch hold of this Dhanvantri and make sure that we only get all the Amritam, and the Deva should not get any of the share. So they start grabbing the Amrita Kalasham from Dhanvantri's hand, and there is a big fight going on. So the Kalasham keeps passing from one hand to another. Fortunately, probably the Kalasham was sealed properly and all that, so nothing was dropped down, no Amritam was lost. Okay, so the Kalasham was able to move from one hand to another intact with no loss of Amritam. And all of this fight is happening, and the Devas are looking at the whole thing helplessly, because they are already a defeated team. You know, this is the time when Devas have lost the battle and the Asuras have an upper hand, and the number of Asuras is also double their size. So they are completely, you know, at a loss. They can't do anything. So they start praying again, and then Vishnu comes to their rescue once more. This is one of the other avatarams that you see in the Amritamasanam story. So Vishnu comes in the form of a very beautiful, charming woman. You know, very attractively, you know, glamorously dressed, and he just walks past, you know, in that battlefield. You know, imagine a woman like that walking through a battlefield. You know, it's a very beautiful, portion in Bhagavatam that this whole thing is described. And the Asuras stop their fight and start looking at this woman. They are all so enchanted and charmed by this lady that they want to know who is this, what is she doing in this battlefield, and then they go and start talking to her, and they say, who are you, where are you coming from and all that. So Vishnu in this Mohini Rupam, he says very mischievously, you know, I am just a Vibhachari. No, Vibhachari means a woman of a bad character.
That means she goes after one man after the other as she pleases. That is the name Vibhachari. Yeah? Vishnu says, you know, I am actually Vibhachari and you people are so cultured and educated, you shouldn't be talking to me. Okay? So Vishnu tries to tell them that, you know, you people should stay away from me. Don't come near me. Okay, but the asuras won't have anything of it. They say, no, no, you look so great and, you know, so beautiful. I think you can do us a favor. Then Vishnu asks, what is this favor you want us? They say, you know, we have this amritam and you must make sure that, you know, we get this amritam distributed properly and fairly. So you should help us distribute this amritam among us. And then Vishnu says, you know, I am okay with that, but, you know, you should not challenge whatever I do. You know, you should allow me to do whatever I do. Anything I do, you should keep quiet. You should not challenge me. Then the asuras say, yeah, that's fine. We know that you will take care of us. So, we trust you. And they hand over the Amrita Kalasham to Mohini. And then, you know, what Mohini says, you know, these devas, they're all poor beggars. They don't have the power. You know, they're powerless people and they're, you know, like hungry children, they're clamoring for food. You know, you shouldn't be sitting next to them. So, I think you should sit separately from the devas. So, with that, she makes the asuras sit separately and the devas separately. And she says, you know, these hungry kids, I think I should take care of them first. So, let me first attend to them and then I'll come to you. And then she starts, this Mohini starts distributing the amritam to the devas. And once in a while, she will come on the asura's side and say a few smiling words and, you know, beautiful words and keep them enchanted and then keep going to the other side. And she, Mohini Avatara, continues to serve this amritam to the devas, carefully making sure that none of the asuras get the amritam. And while this is happening, the asuras, most of them are kind of looking at the girl and, you know, wondering about, you know, how beautiful she is and all that. And one guy, Rahu, he realizes, he's a little sharp. He says, look, this amritam is not going to come to our side at all, so we have to do something. And he quickly changes his get-up and dresses up like a deva and goes and sits on the side of the deva. Quietly, without anybody noticing, he goes and sits on the side of the deva. And he sits between Chandran and Suryan. So he ends up sitting between Surya and Chandra. And Vishnu also, Mohini doesn't notice this changeover. And she serves Amritam to this Rahu and he also puts it in his mouth and swallows. Just at that moment, both Surya and Chandra tell Mohini, this guy is not a Deva, he is an Asura. So immediately Mohini takes the Chakram, Sudarshana Chakram and cuts off Rahu's head. But by then he had already consumed the Amritam, so he becomes immortal. So his body becomes into two parts. His head is separate, the body part is separate. That is the according to Bhagavatam, that is when the Rahu and Ketu came into existence and they became the 8th and 9th planets. Until then, apparently, there were only 7 planets in the system and Rahu and Ketu become the 8th and 9th planets. So, if you go to the Navagraha Sannidhi of any temple, you will find that Rahu has a human body and a snake, human head and snake body. And Ketu has a human body and a snake head. Yeah, so that is the significance. So it is actually Rahu and Ketu coming from the same person. The bodies are alive. It's one body cut into two. They are both alive. And the missing portion is taken over by the serpent. That is a symbolic thing. We will talk about Rahu and Ketu after the story is over. Okay. So with all this pandemonium, somehow Mohini Avatara Vishnu manages to distribute the entire Amritam only to the Devas and carefully make sure that none of the asuras are able to get the amritam and she vanishes. So that settles the amritam matanam part. So now the devas have consumed the amritam and asuras have been deprived of the amritam and the whole project is over. Now some time later, Lord Shiva comes to Vaikuntha and Vishnu and Shiva have a conversation. Lord Shiva comes to Vaikuntha along with Parvati. And then at that time he asked Vishnu, you know, I heard that during the Amrita Mathanam project towards the end, you came as a Mohini Avatara and somehow I missed that Avatara, so I want to see your Mohini Avatara. So Shiva also wants to enjoy that Mohini Avatara, vision. Then Vishnu tries to, dissuade him from, this whole desire. He says, no, I somehow managed to fool the Devas and Asuras with that Mohini Avatara. But, you are beyond all that, you are a very Sreshta Purusha. So, I don't want to, make a fool out of you. So, I think you should be happy not seeing the Mohini Avatara. But Shiva insists. He insists 2-3 times, no, that's okay, I'll keep myself under control and all that. So, Shiva says so much. So, Vishnu says, okay, I will show you. And then he vanishes. Okay? And then Vishnu has vanished and Shiva is waiting and nothing is happening. He thinks Vishnu is going to come in front of him. But suddenly he says at a long, about half a kilometer away, a very beautiful woman playing with a ball. Okay, Vishnu has gone and he's showing his Mohini Rupa from there. But Shiva, in that heat of the moment, he just forgets all this and he starts running after that girl. And the girl, Mohini is also Maya Swarupi, So this girl runs with the ball all over the place and Shiva is chasing the girl. And finally, he is not able to catch hold of the girl also. And then the girl disappears after some time. And then Shiva kind of wonders what happened and then he comes back. And then he realizes, this girl was the Mohini Avatara. So, the Bhagavatam story, this episode may sound a little like, insulting to Lord Shiva. Yeah, but later in the same Bhagavatam, Lord Shiva recounts this episode to Parvati herself and says that, I thought I will somehow manage, maintain my mental control, but even I lost my mental control in front of this Mohini Avatara. So this tells the glory of Lord Vishnu, how he can control everybody's mind. So the conclusion Lord Shiva draws out of this whole thing is that Vishnu is supreme. So we have to take the story, not as some kind of a depreciative remark on Lord Shiva, but it is in the Shastras, it is very often this technique. I told about this in the last class also. There is something called a Arthavada. And Arthavada means glorification. And sometimes to glorify Vishnu, you talk a little deprecatingly about Shiva. And in Shiva Purana, you will find such deprecating references about Vishnu also. To glorify Shiva, they will say, Vishnu was, doing something foolish or whatever. So it is not about Vishnu being superior or Shiva being superior. It is just to show that in this particular context, again, recalling what I told in the very first talk, in Bhagavatam, Vishnu represents the infinite principle. Vishnu represents the Paramatma. And all other devatas, including Shiva and Brahma, represent the finite entity. So, the purpose of all these Puranas is to show that the infinite is always superior to the finite. So, in this context, Shiva represents finitude. So, we have to understand that finitude is inferior to infinitude. So, that is the conclusion to draw from this story. Now let's go back to the significance of this whole story. So what is the Shastra or the Purana trying to tell us through this story? There are a lot of lessons you can learn from this. The first lesson, at the very first step, what Lord Vishnu is saying is that whenever you involve or whenever you start something which is a very big initiative or a project, you have to somehow involve and bring into the project even your adversaries. Because if your adversaries are outside of your initiative, then you give them room to create trouble for you. So, if you bring the troublemakers as close to you as possible, number one, you get the buy-in from them and they agree to work with you, so you reduce the chances of getting into trouble. You reduce the number of troublemakers and the number of obstacles. And secondly, even if there is some troublemaker, part of that group, you will come to know about it very fast because you have made sure that they work closely with you. So when there is a non-cooperation, you come to know sooner than later. So this is a strategy that even people in today's world, we can adopt it. Whenever we start a project, see, very often you see that big initiatives and projects are started to show that we are great. And when we do that, we knowingly or unknowingly alienate a few groups and those groups want to teach us a lesson by making sure that we fail. So very often, you know, in the very recent recent months or few months, the Bombay Metro project was a big problem, because one group of people said that, you know, you can't destroy the forests, and there's a lot of agitation to stop a particular section of the Bombay Metro. Just one example, you know, Bombay Metro is actually a project which is supposed to benefit the whole city, but then there was a group of people who wanted to stop the project in some places because they said that, you know, they are affected by something or the other. And you find all these agitations happening. There's another agitation I remember is the Kudangulam atomic power project, for which a lot of hangama was happening 6-7 years back. So any such agitation, what you see is the stakeholders who are potential troublemakers are not bought over or brought over. And in this story, we learn that it is very important to identify who are all our possible troublemakers and try to include them in the initiative so that we get least resistance. That is the first lesson that you learn. Okay. Then the second lesson is that, if you notice, when the Devas and Asuras started lifting the Mandara Parvata, initially they were full of energy and enthusiasm, but then they realized that they are not able to carry it much far. And then they had to pray to the Lord. Okay, so the second lesson here is that while you might have started something based on very good advice and very good preparation and all that, you still need a lot of divine grace to be successful. So at any point in any project, things can go wrong. You know, in this project also a lot of things went wrong. Initially the Mandara Parvata slipped and fell, and after that the Parvatam got stuck in the Samudram, and you needed Vishnu as Kurma Avatara, and after that the Halahala Visham came, you had to go to the Shiva for consuming it. So at every point of time in the course of the initiative, you will need a lot of divine grace to achieve success. So never be taken over by ego and pride that, you know, I am doing it. You know, you may think you are doing it, but you will need a lot of cooperation and help from a lot of other people. You know, and that is also symbolically mentioned in the Bhagavatam itself, that when the churning was happening, Lord Vishnu was present under the Parvatam as Kurmavatara. He was holding the Parvatam from the top so that it doesn't topple and fall. He entered the bodies of Devas and Asuras to give them the energy. He entered the body of Vasuki serpent to give the serpent some energy. So, really speaking, it is the Lord who makes all of us function. You know, that is the other lesson or the message that we get. While, you know, we all move about in this world through our life thinking that, you know, I have achieved this, I have achieved that, I am a great guy and all that. All that we have achieved has been possible because of blessing from the divine. Without the divine blessing, there is nothing that you can do on your own. That's a very important message that the story underlines. And in fact, this same idea is given in so many different places, in so many different scriptures. We just finished the Bhagavad Gita 10th chapter last week. And the entire 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita is to tell that nothing in this world can function without the influence or the blessing of the Lord. So the 10th chapter is a very good example of, you know, you can say it's a summary of this Samudra Mathanam story. So anything and everything that we do, it is the Lord who makes us capable of doing it. So that understanding, that humility we should carry with us. So that is the next message that you get from the Samudra Mathanam. And there is a philosophical, you know, interpretation of this whole Samudra Mathanam, which is very interesting. Now this Amritam or immortality for which the Devas and Asuras are, you know, going through this whole process, that Amritam is nothing but Brahma Vidya, as in the essential teachings that you find in all the Upanishads. Okay, and the Brahma Vidya makes the person immortal. Brahma Vidya is essentially a knowledge, self-knowledge. It's called the knowledge of the infinite. Okay? And all the Upanishads are teaching the same Brahma Vidya in very different stories and languages and all that. And the Bhagavad Gita also is a summary of all the Upanishads. So when you go through the Bhagavad Gita, you learn this Brahma Vidya in a certain structured manner. And so this Amritam represents this Brahma Vidya. And this milky ocean that the Devas and Asuras churned is nothing but our mind, our intellect. You know, the milky ocean is white in color. And in the Shastras, the Sattva Guna is represented by the white color. And in the Shastras, the word Sattva is also synonymous with your mind. Because the mind is supposed to be Sattva predominant. Because Sattva Guna, as I told in the beginning of this class, represents your mental faculty, thinking faculty, and you know, everything to do with your thought process. So, since the mind's main function is to think and to process the thought, obviously the mind has to have a lot of Sattva Guna. So, this milky ocean that is talked about in the Bhagavatam story is nothing but your intellect and your mind. And this Mandara Parvatam with which you churn, that Mandara Parvatam is nothing but the Vedantic teaching. All the teachings, that is, this story symbolically says that if you have to realize Brahman, if you have to realize your true self, you have to take recourse to Shastras and scriptures. And Shastras, when I say Shastras, it is essentially the Veda Antabhaga, which is the Upanishadic portion. So the Mandara Parvata represents the Upanishadic teachings. Okay. And by comparing the Mandara Parvata to Upanishad or Upanishad to Mandara Parvata, the Shastra wants to say that the teaching is solid. It is as solid as a mountain, you cannot really move it. So it's really rock solid teaching that you have to use in order to churn the mind. Yeah? And this churning the mind is nothing but the process of understanding the teaching and to remove all doubts that we may have with respect to the teaching. Because the teaching, when you hear the teaching, you will find it difficult to believe. And you will have a lot of questions. Is this true? Is that true? And so on. So, the teaching is simple, but to understand and internalize the teaching, you have to go through a lot of what we call mananam. Mananam means to answer all the questions that come out of this teaching. So that process is a churning process. It is the process of discussing and debating and question-answer sessions with the guru. All those things represent the churning process. And the halahala visham that comes out is nothing but our own toxicity, our own negativities, our own negative behavior and negative thoughts and so on. See, when you start in this process of spiritual learning and once you start in the spiritual process of learning the Upanishadic teaching and all that, you end up doing a lot of meditation, you sit quietly and reflect on the teachings. At that time, the mind quietens, you kind of withdraw from all your day-to-day stress and worries and all that. But when that mind is quiet, all your pent-up past problems and worries and all the old guilt and all those negativities will surface. And it is very important to handle all these negativities and get over that phase. And the story describing Lord Shiva consuming the halahala visham is nothing but symbolic of we surrendering to Lord Shiva or to Ishvara and saying that you please help me to handle this negativity and toxicity. No, we cannot handle our own negativity and toxicity. And you know, when we say negativity and toxicity, it is not just what you accumulate in this Janma. It is the negativity that we have accumulated over so many Janmas and which remain in us as our Vasanas. So when somebody starts on this spiritual journey, the first obstacle that we will face is our own negativities and our own, you know, toxic behavior and all those guilt and anger and jealousy that is pent up in us. It will come at some level. And this toxicity we have to be able to recognize and identify and say, hey Lord, this is an obstacle, please absorb it and relieve me of this pain. So that process is symbolically shown here as Lord Shiva consuming the halahala visham. Okay? And all those goody-goody things that come until Amritam comes, all of them are nothing but the so-called Ashta Siddhis. You know, when you are seriously in the spiritual practice, you could get a lot of Siddhis. And Siddhis are actually special powers. Maybe, you know, you may get some intuitions. You may get some flash of thoughts that something is going to happen tomorrow and it will come through. Okay? And you will see that this is happening on a consistent basis. Then you may start pursuing that Siddhi and drop your ultimate goal of getting Brahma Vidya. So these Siddhis that come in between are more of an obstacle to your sadhana, and you should not let yourself be tempted by these Siddhis. And you know, a lot of people, they start this spiritual process and somewhere along the line they get some Siddhi or the other, and then they get distracted and they pursue the Siddhi more seriously and they drop this Brahma Vidya, you know, exercise. So that is the word of caution that Bhagavatam wants to say, that you may get lot of different Siddhis. So you may be able to read somebody's mind. You know, I'm not saying you will get it. I'm saying you might get it. Getting a Siddhi again depends on your own prarabdha and depends on what kind of sadhanas you do. So if it so happens that you have this spiritual practice and suddenly you get into some Siddhi, don't get distracted by the Siddhi, but ignore it and proceed with your ultimate destination in mind, that I have to be a self-aware, liberated person. I have to learn the Brahma Vidya and perfect my knowledge on Brahma Vidya. So that, you know, steady focus on the end result has to be very closely pursued. So that is another lesson that we learn, that even though you may get some small benefits here and there, don't get tempted. And you know, this Kalpataru and Kamadhenu, really speaking, they are nothing but our own creativity. You know, if you look at this world today, in the last 150-200 years, all these scientific inventions and industrial revolution and then the information revolution, all those things that you see, all these economic and technological progress that mankind has made, is all come from creativity. And creativity is something that comes from your mind, but assisted by divine grace. You know, in the Shastras, what we say is, you don't discover anything new. You don't discover anything new. All the knowledge that is, you know, available in the past, present and future is there somewhere out there. You know, we have something called a cosmic mind. Cosmic mind, in Sanskrit the word is Hiranyagarbha. And that Hiranyagarbha is symbolically represented as Brahmaji, Brahma with four heads. Okay. That Brahmaji represents the cosmic mind. And Brahmaji, at the very beginning of creation, learns all the knowledges, all bodies of knowledge that is there ever to be learned. Brahmaji learns from Lord Narayana. And this knowledge, Brahmaji decides to pass on to humanities and other devas and other asuras and everybody according to the need of the time. So if there is a scientist who came up with some, you know, wonderful discovery, of course his own effort is very much there, but for him to get that flash of the knowledge, he needed the divine assistance. So Brahmaji, the cosmic mind, would have chosen to send that particular piece of knowledge at that point of time to that person. So while the person, let's say Newton, theory of gravity, or Einstein, theory of relativity, you should give credit to Newton and Einstein. I'm not saying that you should not give credit. But whatever Newton or Einstein or anybody else might have discovered came from the cosmic mind, and it chose to enter the world through their head. In exactly the same way, in the Vedas also, the Vedas are not created by the rishis. The Vedas are received by the rishis. So when the rishis go into a deep state of meditation, their mind becomes so sattvic that they are able to connect directly with the cosmic mind. And then in that state of meditation, they are able to receive the suktams or the mantras. And that, whatever they receive, they have transmitted to the rest of the world. That is how the Vedas have been, you know, put together. So while you will find in the Veda mantras that, you know, this suktam is given by this and this rishi, you will actually see the name of the rishi in the Veda suktam. It doesn't mean that they wrote it. They didn't create it. They were the receivers of the Veda mantra. You know, our Guru Swami Paramarthananda very humorously says, Receivati iti rishi. You know, in Sanskrit, there is a way of defining a word. Rama has a name, Dasarathi. So that Dasarathi has a definition, Dasaratasya apatyam puman iti Dasarathi. So Dasaratha's son is Dasarathi. So every word has a definition. So he defines the word Rishi by saying, Receivati iti Rishi. Okay, it's a humorous definition, but it is just to drive home the idea that the rishis were not the original creators of the Veda mantra, but they received it. It is exactly like how you have a radio set or a television set, and you have a tuning condenser, and depending upon which station you tune it, you receive a different station. You know, nowadays, very few people listen to the radios. There was a time when we were school children, we would listen to, sitting in Chennai, we'll listen to BBC or Voice of America or Radio Australia and all those, you know, Vivid Bharati and all those channels. So depending on which setting you put on the radio, you will receive that particular program. So the rishis were able to program their mind and elevate their mind to a certain sattvic level that they are able to receive the teaching from the cosmic mind. Okay. So this Kalpataru, Kamadhenu, they are all essentially the creativity of the human mind, and you can use the creativity for good ends and you can use it for bad ends also. You know, creativity is nothing but a tool, and nuclear weapons, for instance, nuclear power, you know, the atomic power is nothing but a phenomenon, whether you use it for generating electricity and using it in a constructive manner, or whether you use the nuclear knowledge to build bombs and destroy countries, it's entirely in our hands. So the Kalpataru, Kamadhenu, all these things, they represent the creativity. And again, the caution is, yes, creativity is a blessing, but you should be able to use it properly. If you don't use your creativity properly, you'll get into trouble. So these are all some of the lessons that we can learn. And there is yet another yogic or tantric definition to the whole story. So what I heard is, our spinal cord, you know, the backbone, there is a spinal cord, and around the spinal cord there are three nadis. Okay, there is ila, pingala and sushumna. There are three nadis, and you see these nadis mentioned in Lalita Sahasranamam also. So, in fact, in some of the Upanishads, the Upasaka's journey to the Brahmaloka is described, and there it is mentioned that when the Upasaka leaves this body at the end of his life, his soul or his jiva travels through the Sushumna nadi and leaves the body. Okay, so that's not really relevant here, but what I'm trying to say is, this Ila, Pingala and Sushumna are three of the main nadis. You know, we have something like 72 lakh something nadis in our body. Okay, and there are some main nadis, and then there are some subsidiary nadis, and then there are fine nadis. It's exactly like your blood vessel, but they are not blood vessels. Nadis are not blood vessels, nadis are not nerves, nadis are nadis. Okay, there is no translation. And they are some kind of a channel through which energy is channelized in the body. And all the nadis begin in the heart. And the Sushumna nadi is supposed to lead from the heart to the top of the head. Okay, and so this Vasuki serpent is a symbolic representation of the three nadis, Ila, Pingala and Sushumna, or Ida, Ida, Pingala, Sushumna. Yeah, and the Mandara Parvatam is your spinal cord itself. And so the idea is, by practicing certain yogic asanas and practices, and by practicing certain way of pranayamam, you are able to channelize your prana through these three nadis. So the, you know, this is again a tantric approach, and I'm not entirely familiar with how this tantric approach works, but the tantric approach says that your body is a divine temple, and you have to train your body and mind to realize the temple and the divinity in you, and then you use your you know, the way of breathing, your prana, and your by controlling your breathing and by controlling your other organs, you achieve a certain state of mind, and then you remain in that state for as long as possible, and then you achieve samadhi and all that. So there is an approach to, you know, achieving liberation through the tantric route, and in this process they also use a lot of mantras. I've just heard about it in bits and pieces, so I'm not the right guy to explain all that. But basically, this explanation about the spinal cord being the Mandara Parvatam and the Ila, Pingala, Sushumna being the Vasuki and all that is just another parallel, you know, interpretation of what this whole Samudra Mathanam means. Okay, but whatever it is, ultimately the goal is to get Amritam. Amritam is immortality, and immortality means liberation from this cycle of birth and death, which I think we have been talking about in all the 6 days of stories in some form or the other. And the message from Bhagavatam is that ultimately, if you want liberation, if you want moksha, Lord Narayana is the ultimate divinity on whose feet you surrender and, you know, put yourself there. So that developing that bhakti, that developing that mindset is the reason why all these stories are given. And for those who can follow the abstract teachings, there are a lot of abstract portions in Bhagavatam. For those who are not so tuned to abstract teachings, then there are these stories which talk about, a beautiful figure with the Shankha Chakra in hand, and, you know, beautiful face and smiling face, Kaustubhahara. All those descriptions are given so that you can imagine that form and meditate. And slowly that kind of meditation is supposed to enable you to reach that abstract level where you can appreciate the teaching. So this is the Samudra Mathanam story, and if there are any questions, we can discuss. Anybody from the conference? Silence. Come close, come close. One minute. There's somebody asking from the conference, so I'll finish that, and by the time you can come here. I want your voice to be loud. That's why I'm asking you to come here. Yeah, on the conference, who's that, please?
This is Krishna Prasad. So,
yeah.
When you were telling the story, and especially the takeaways, I was just wondering, in Sandhya Vandanam, there is one mantra which is says Sarva Vedekshu Yat Punyam, Sarva Teerthekshu Yat Phalam, Tat Phalam Samavapnoti, Sutava Devam Janardhanam. So, is that mantra, in a way, by chanting that mantra every day during Sandhya Vandanam, are we supposed to remind ourselves every day that whatever we do is done by Him, and we should not get carried away by this?
Okay. So, I'll explain the question first. Okay. I can't explain the whole question because he quoted one shloka which I don't know. Okay. Basically, his question was about Sandhya Vandanam. And in Sandhya Vandanam, he says there is a particular mantra which implies that everything is taken care of by Lord Vishnu. And so his question is the entire tatparyam or the significance of doing Sandhya Vandanam is to remind ourselves on a daily basis that it is Lord Vishnu who is, you know, making us move. Okay, so Krishna Prasad, very good question. So let me first talk about Sandhya Vandanam itself. Okay, now there are different parts of Sandhya Vandanam, and there are different mantras that come in Sandhya Vandanam. This whole Sandhya Vandanam concept is to make us improve our ability to sit and meditate, and in that meditation turn our mind to the Lord. That is the primary, you know, that is the primary purpose of Sandhya Vandanam. And by doing it 3 times a day regularly throughout your life, you create a certain habit. And that creating that sattva habit is also another important aspect. And during the Sandhya Vandanam, if you carefully observe, you pay your obeisance or respect to all the 5 bhutas: Akasha, Vayu, Agni, Prithvi, and Jalam. Okay, when you finish Sandhya Vandanam, you have a portion where you say Purva, you turn to the eastern direction, Prachyam Dishaya Namaha, Dakshina Dishaya Namaha, Pratichyaya Namaha, Udichyaya Namaha, and Urdhvaya Namaha, Adraya Namaha, Antarikshaya Namaha, Bhumiya Namaha, you say all that, right? So yeah, in that portion you are worshipping the directions, which is nothing but manifestation of space. So you are treating space itself as sacred. Okay. And then when you take water in your hand and say, Apohishta, Mayobhuvaha, Tana Urje, Dadhatana, you sprinkle, spray yourself, and then finally you have this what is called not Achamaniyam, but Prashanam. You do Prashanam with certain mantras for the morning, afternoon, and evening, Apohishta the mantrasya, okay? Apohishta Mayobhuvaha. No, Apohishta is Prokshanam. Anyway, so all these mantras, you pray to Lord Varuna and tell, hey Lord Varuna, you are divine and you please help me, maintaining my body. That is a prayer to Jalam. And by performing Pranayamam during the Sandhya Vandanam, you are treating Vayu as Pranatattvam, which is sacred. Okay, and then when you sit on the floor for doing Pranayamam and Gayatri Japam, you say, Prithvi Tvaya Dhrita Loka Devi Tvam Vishnuna Dhrita Tvamcha Dharemam Devi Pavitram Purushasanam. There you are paying obeisance to the earth. Okay. And in the evening mantra, you invoke Agni and say, I do the Prashanam for Agni, and so on. So what I am trying to say is, in the Sandhya Vandanam, there is a comprehensive, teaching that everything that you see around you is sacred and pervaded by the Lord. And even so-called inanimate things like water and fire and air and earth are also divine. So the attitude to view this whole creation as divine is being imbibed in us through this Sandhya Vandanam. Okay, and incidentally, there is another place where you say, "Aham Brahmasmi, Brahma Iva Satyam." Okay. After you do the prayachitta, argyam, you have 3 argyams, and then you have the durita argyam, and then when you do the durita argyam, you turn around your own body. At that point, you say, "Aham Brahmasmi, Brahmaiva Satyam." That "Aham Brahmasmi," even though there it is given as a casual mantra, that is the teaching. That is the teaching that we are supposed to internalize and learn. So the Sandhya Vandanam ritual is a very beautiful ritual. Without our own knowledge, we learn the Brahma Vidya on a daily basis. But the problem is, we don't pay attention to it. We just chant it mechanically as a mantra and get along.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Apo Jyotiraso Amritam Brahma Bhurbhuvasu Om. But just before that, we say, "Aham Brahmasmi, Brahmaiva Satyam." Okay? Yeah. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you. It was very, very
right, sir.
Very inspiring. It inspired me to do more.
Thank you, sir.
You
okay, you. Arun, your question now.
We talked about Rahu Ketu, right?
Yeah.
So you told you elaborate something
about. Yeah. See, basically, whether Rahu and Ketu came into existence because of that, being cut or not, is incidental. In the astrological world of Indian Shastra, Rahu and Ketu are not really physical planets. Okay, they are called Chaya Graham, and there is the sun, and the earth is moving around the sun. And then
around the earth, the moon is moving. So there is an orbit of the earth around the sun, and there is an orbit of the moon around the earth. Okay? Now you take the plane. You know, when you draw a circle, there is a plane associated with it. So you take the plane of earth's revolution around the sun, and take the plane of moon's revolution around the earth. These two planes will intersect at two points. You know, you got to do some 3D visualization here. Okay? So there is a plane which represents the earth's motion around the sun. There is another plane. These two planes are not parallel. These two planes are inclined to each other. So it is like one plane being like this, another plane being like this. And when these two planes intersect, there are two points. Those two points are Rahu and Ketu. So it is actually a mathematical concept. Rahu and Ketu are essentially mathematical points. And when the new moon and the full moon days come, the moon is either, the moon, sun and the earth are in the same line. Okay? So, we know that eclipse takes place when the moon comes in between the earth and the sun, or the earth comes in between the moon and the sun. Okay? So, one would wonder, why is not an eclipse taking place on every new moon day and every full moon day? Because eclipses take place only on a full moon day and a new moon day. The lunar eclipse always takes place on a full moon day. The solar eclipse always takes place on a new moon day. Because only on a new moon day, the moon is between the sun and the earth. Only on a full moon day, the earth is between the moon and the sun. So technically, you should have an eclipse every 15 days. On a new moon day, you must have a solar eclipse, and a full moon day, you must have a lunar eclipse. But it doesn't happen that way. It is because the plane which represents this, you know, intersection point, that also has to be facing the 90 degree side. So only in certain positions of the earth and the moon or the sun, the eclipse can take place. And this is available through calculations. And if you take any panchangam, especially the Drit Ganita Panchangam, which is published in Kerala, it will give you the degrees at which the Rahu and Ketu are located. And if you check the day on which the eclipse happens, you will find that the sun and Rahu are in the same square, same degrees. To the measurement of half a degree or 1 degree, they give you the accuracy. So that is the level of calculation our Shastras had enabled even 5,000, 10,000 years back, because these Panchangams are all coming from 10,000 years back. So the astronomical accuracy of our calculations are so thorough that we can predict an eclipse 50 years down the line, or even 100 years down the line. That's the level of accuracy we have. So, I mean, this explanation has nothing to do with Bhagavatam. It is just to show how our Shastras are so perfect that we had mastered the astronomical, calculations long back.
And it's
not a physical place. It's not a physical graham. It's a point. It's a mathematical point. So imagine the level of visualization that our rishis must have, possessed, to come to this level of calculation and say this is how it is.
Yes. Yeah? The reason I asked is because in Egyptian mythology they also had a similar concept, sun and moon, and they also have an interaction between a shape of a snake and a human being. So it's very interesting that it's a little bit of similar.
See, what I say may be controversial, but there was a time when the Hindu Vedic culture had prevailed in as far west as Egypt, and probably even in the what is parts of Europe today, and on the eastern side all the way to Cambodia and even Japan. Okay, there was a time when the Vedic culture had spread. So there is a place called Assyria, A-S-S-Y-R-I-A. Okay, I don't know where it is, somewhere in the Middle East. and some 30-40 years back they discovered some artifacts in the archaeological thing, and it was called the Hittite agreement. And that Hittite agreement somebody had deciphered, and they find that there is a reference to Mitra and Varuna in that agreement. So it's a Hittite slab, stone slab. And the Egyptians had the sun as their god. Okay. And we are sun worshippers. Basically, Hindus are sun worshippers, because when you do Sandhya Vandanam, what are you doing? In Sandhya Vandanam, you are welcoming the sun god into the world when you do early morning Sandhya Vandanam. And you are praying to the sun god in the noon by thanking the sun god for having provided all the sunlight which sustains us, because we cannot, this earth cannot survive without the sun. So essentially the sun worshipping is part of the Sandhya Vandanam that Krishna Prasad asked. And the worship we do in the evening is not so much for the sun, but it is for the Lord Varuna. Because Lord Varuna is the devata for the western direction. You know, in our shastras, all the eight directions have a devata. So we have east, west, north, south, and then we have northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, the eight directions. And all the eight directions have their devatas. So the eastern direction devata is Indra. The southern direction devata is Yama. Western direction devata is Varuna. And the northern direction has two devatas, Soma and Kubera. Okay? So, in the evening, because the sun is setting on the western side, you pray to Varuna. So that's the only exception. Even though you give the Argyam to Surya, rest of the prayer happens to Varuna. Okay? So, the idea of Egyptians worshipping sun god, I am sure must have gone from here. Okay? So there is in fact, I have a theory, I don't know whether this is actually validated by somebody or not. If you go to the South American cultures, the old Mayan civilization, you know, Aztec civilization, Inca civilization, all that, you see many of their symbols, they all look very much like Hindu symbols. So, my theory is that there was a time long, long back when all these continents were one landmass. There were one landmass, and there is one culture which had prevailed all over the world, and then at some point, due to some tectonic shift or something, these land masses moved away. Because if you study deeply the practices of the Native Americans, who are now called Red Indians, you know, they are called shaman practices. Many of their practices resemble our tantric practices. Okay, so I have a strong feeling that the whole world had the Vedic culture at some point, and then they separated and a lot of it was lost. Any more questions? They will not, I didn't say they will get, they might get.
Where our machines have cured many illnesses, mm-hmm. But I always wondered why they didn't take them curing illness as their promotion later, but now I got the answer that probably because they don't want to get carried away by the city, but only use the machines for some people, right?
Yeah, see, our Vedic approach is sometimes, you know, you might think it is very hard-hearted or very cruel or whatever, but our rishis had this approach that this world is a temporary station. Okay? This world is a temporary station, and there is much more to life than simply enjoying a luxurious, happy life on this earth. So, while they knew that there are possibilities to become prosperous and luxurious and enjoy a lot of comfort, they did not focus on developing them and making them public, because they also realized that if you promote that kind of a mindset, it will lead to a lot of, you know, what is happening today. You know, in today's world, the problem that you see is that everybody is focusing on how can I be rich and how can I be comfortable and how can I be materially well off. and that is leading to a lot of problems. You cannot live, you know, in social harmony and in harmony with nature. Our rishis believe that, yes, there are some problems, like, you know, you can suddenly die and, you know, you can have illness and all those things, but there is a life after this. So it doesn't matter, even if you are sick and you are suffering, it doesn't matter. Only in extreme cases, very exceptional cases, they came out with these powers and healed somebody. Okay? So they did not want to interfere in the way of nature, and they said it is all Bhagavat Sankalpam. It is all divine ordainment or whatever you call it. And we as human beings should not interfere in the divine way of things. Because if you start interfering, you cannot say what repercussions it will have. Like, for instance, today you have these scientists who want to play God, and they are using all kinds of technologies to create genetically modified grains and animals and all that. Now, slowly we are finding that these genetically modified things are not all bed of roses. It can suddenly cause some problem, like whatever SARS or MERS or coronavirus that you are seeing, they are all part of some experiment which went wrong. Okay, so while there is a hope that you may improve something by some research, you don't take into account all the negative results or the negative repercussions that may come out of it. So our rishis are very cautious. And for them, this world, this life is a temporary station. You're there for 30, 40, 50 years. In their vision, this whole cosmos is running into trillions of years. No, when you look on a scale of several trillions of years, what is 40, 50, 60 years? It is not even a droplet of a droplet. It's a minute fraction. And if you die, that's not the end of your story. You will continue. You have another loka, another body, another janma. And they address the larger problem that, look, if you are going to keep on moving from body to body to body endlessly, when will this whole thing stop? And they gave a solution to get out of this chain of birth and death. So that was the approach. Yeah. So the vision of the rishis was much bigger than the vision of the most visionary leader today that we have. Any more?
Yeah. We have the 10 avataras of Lord Mahavishnu. Why is Mohini avatara not considered there?
See, in the Bhagavatam itself, there is a section that says that there are numerous avataras of the Lord. It is not just 10. In fact, in the Bhagavatam, there is a place where 24 avataras are mentioned. And in these 24 avataras, this Kapila Rishi that I mentioned is one of the avataras. Vyasa is one of the avataras. Then the Rishi Narada is one of the avataras. And like that, there are a lot of avataras. And in the Bhagavatam itself, in different skandhas, it is mentioned that Lord Narayana was born as some Manu or some Indra or something. So there are infinite number of avataras. And if you are a follower of the Advaitic tradition will say that every human being is an avatar. The only problem is we don't know that we are an avatar. Okay, what is an avatar? Avatar is an entity that comes with a piece of divinity. And as I said, in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, there is no place in this creation where I am not present. Anything that you touch in this world, I am present in that. That means what? Everything is an avatara, ultimately. So the idea about talking about 20 avataras or 24 avataras or 10 avataras is to give you some ideals, some high points. You know, when we make a report for a weekly report or a monthly report, you don't talk about everything that you did from morning to evening. No, you don't say, I came to the office at 8 o'clock and I did that, I did this. You don't write 25 pages of report. You want to do a two PPT or a 3-slide, 4-slide report and say, these are the highlights, these are the lowlights or whatever. You talk only about the important things that are worth mentioning. So these 10 avataras or 24 avataras are like your report. Because this creation has been going on and on and on for endless time. So if you really want to talk about everything that the Lord did, you cannot cover everything in one lifetime. So to give you the essential, you know, highlights of what the Lord did, you have some Puranas. even those 18 Puranas and 18 Upapuranas, you cannot read all in your lifetime and digest. That itself is so voluminous. So, it is just to make our life easier, that's all. Was that okay? Right. Can we close? Yeah. I have no idea. You know, I have also read the story about Jnaneshwar, you know, taking Samadhi and then reappearing in front of Paramahamsa Yogananda and all that. I'm not familiar with those theories, first of all, but I can answer from the limited knowledge that I have about Mayika Shariram and Bhautika Shariram. You know, the Lord is capable of appearing in any form, in any place, as He wishes. That is how Narasimha Avatara happened. That is how Kurma Avatara happened. You know, Kurma Avatara means what? The Lord simply decided to appear as a tortoise and He appeared. So He is able to manifest Himself in that form. And there are certain Siddhas. Siddhas are people who have this Siddhi. Siddhi is this special power. You know, there are, in our Shastras, there are 8 Siddhis which are said as Ashtamaha Siddhis. And it says Anima, Mahima, Garima, Laghima, and 4 more are there. So this Anima means this Siddha can shrink himself into such a small atomic size. He can change his body and become such a small size. And in Ramayana you find Hanuman doing it. So when Hanuman wants to go around on a tour of Lanka searching for Sita, he shrinks himself into such a small body that he is invisible. And then he goes around into Ravana's Antapuram and starts looking for Sita. Okay. And Garima means that you can make yourself extremely heavy. And Mahima means you can make yourself huge. And Mahima is also something Hanuman did in Mahabharata, Ramayana. When he went from Rameshwaram to Lanka, he grew in size and became a big giant and went. And Hanuman did that Garima thing in Mahabharata for Bhima. You know, in Mahabharata there is a story where Bhima is sent to bring the Parijata tree, and Bhima goes and searches in Himalayas. You know, Bhima is also Vayuputra and Hanuman is also Vayuputra. And then when he is going in search of this Parijata tree, on the way he finds a monkey, and the monkey's tail is on his path. And then Bhima tells the monkey, "You take your tail off." He doesn't realize that this monkey is nothing but Hanuman. And Hanuman says, "You know, I am too lazy, I am sleepy. You move my tail and you can walk off." Then Bhima thinks, "What monkey, this small monkey, what tail, I can remove it with one finger." He tries and he pulls, tail doesn't move even a millimeter. And then he struggles with the tail for almost 2 hours, 3 hours, and then he realizes something is wrong. And then he falls at the feet of Hanuman, and then Hanuman reveals himself. So that is again, Garima kind of Siddhi. So these are all there, okay. So maybe what Jnaneshwar did was manifest in some form using some of his Siddhis. We don't know whether Jnaneshwar was a Siddhi, Siddha Purusha or whatever. But there are a lot of stories, even Agastya is supposed to be a Siddha. And there are stories that there are a lot of temples in the south where the Shiva Linga that you see in the temple is actually some Siddha or the other who has transformed into a Shiva Linga and doing tapas there. Because there was some story that there was somewhere somebody was digging the land and the axe fell on a Shiva Linga and then blood started coming out of the Shiva Linga. So there is some, these are not really authenticated stories, but these are things that you read here and there. But there is a strong belief that many of the Shivalingas that you see in the temples are not really Shivalingas made of stone, but they are Siddhas who have transformed themselves into Shivalinga and they are doing tapasya there.
There was a yogi called Subhasarvada yogi, and he has been roaming around to Kharda, to Russia, and all. And recently, one delegation from Russia came saying this yogi has been there, and he has given them the address. If you want to know, you can come to this place in Kedarnath. And then they came together, then they came to know that he is already in Samadhi, taken Samadhi before 25 years. And there is understood that the same yogi has been caught by fishermen from the sea. And when they asked, because he is without any clothes and all, they got in the net, they were stunned, and then asked, he was saying he has been doing service for the last 50 years in jail. He was taken to the police station, then he was sent off. And there were a lot of, maybe, as he told, different kind of pithas, perhaps a very.
No, in fact, if you go to Srirangam temple, there is a Ramanuja Sannidhi. No, it's called Udayavar Sannidhi in Tamil. And it is strongly believed that the Ramanuja Vigraha that you see there, the Moolavar, is actually Ramanuja himself. Okay, it is again, this is again hearsay. I have been to Srirangam, I have visited this Ramanuja Sannidhi, and I have tried to make out. But you know, normally these sannidhis, the lighting is not very good. They keep them dark, and only when they show the camphor light, you can see something of the murti. So there are so many such you know, phenomena happening.
Yeah, for example, also Mira, one
person. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Quite possible. Yeah. So ultimately, you know, all these things, whether they are true or not, is not important. Ultimately, all these things have a message that, you know, this body is impermanent, this life is impermanent, this world is impermanent. If there's something beyond all these things, go for the truth. And learn the truth, understand the truth, and you are liberated. That's it. Okay. Can we close? Are we done with all questions? Om Purnamadaha Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi
Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi.